Elizabeth Proud has one of the best-loved and most recognisable voices in the RNIB library. In a career spanning six decades, she's narrated a total of 222 titles, including many by some of the best-loved authors of the last 150 years, such as E. Nesbitt, Philippa Pierce, Catherine Cookson, and Kate Atkinson. So it was an honour to meet her in person when she came to the newly refurbished RNIB Talking Book Studio. Elizabeth, I was doing my homework and I see that we've got 222 books that have been narrated by you, which argues that you've been doing it for a few years now.
Yes, I've been reading for Talking Books for over 52 years now.
Are there any books that really stick out as memorable ones during those 52 years?
Ah, well, of course you do get a lot of things that you don't particularly like. Shall I mention Mills and Boone? Barbara Cartland. I really can't... Well, I have read Barbara Cartland books, but she's very, very difficult to read because she can't write in paragraphs. And the thought doesn't flow, so that is really difficult to read. Somebody that I actually know, I can't really call her a friend, but I love her work, A.S. Byatt. I've done several of her books, quite difficult, but really worth doing. I've done a lot of children's books, which were great to do, because I like children's writing.
Well, the list of children's books is... It's all the great classics, from E. Nesbitt to Jacqueline Wilson, with books like Heidi and Black Beauty and The Silver Sword and Br'er Rabbit. And the list goes on. I know you're reading of Tom's Midnight Garden by...
Philippa Pierce, she's a wonderful writer. Really, really wonderful writer. And it's very interesting that I've been reading something for myself about her writing and about the whole... It's sort of pre-sci-fi, really, because it happens on two time levels, two time scales. Yes, I love that.
Do you prefer reading the children's books to adult fiction, or are you...
No, anything that's good.
I take it you must have been an avid reader from when you were a little girl, otherwise you would never have volunteered to read audiobooks.
Yes, I was a bookworm. I've always been a bookworm. In fact, I learnt to read on my grandfather's knee, reading a book that I've now lost. And I'd be very interested if anybody listening to this could come across it. It was about a funny little creature called Parlicoot, who was a bit like Bambi, looked a little bit like Bambi, and he had some friends. And the first line of the book, which was quite big, but it wasn't a pop-up book, I was three, and sitting on my grandfather's knee, and it was, "One morning, Parlicoot went to see his friends in the forest." And, of course, this was during the Second World War. We didn't have very many books at all. There was no paper, quite apart from anything else. So we'd read it over and over and over again. I knew it backwards, but I remember the moment when the letters, the actual one, O-N-E, morning, when they moved together and became a word instead of separate. I don't know whether that makes any sense, but it was an epiphany to me, and I always, as it were, had my nose in a book after that. I was also very ill when I was a child. I had everything that was going, and then polio. And so I spent a lot of time in bed with a book quite often.
And what led you to the RNIB Talking Book Studios in the first place?
Well, I was stage struck from the age of about four or five. And I wanted to be a ballet dancer, really. But I got polio, so that wasn't possible. But I held on to being stage struck because I had a lovely fairy godmother aunt called Auntie Clara. Now, just think about that name, Clara. Everybody says Clara now, but the English pronunciation, certainly in the 50s, 40s and 50s, was Clara. And the same thing for Mariah. Mariah in Twelfth Night. Shouldn't be Maria. the rhythm is all wrong. Anyway, Auntie Clara was, by our family standards, quite rich. She'd married Wool in Bradford. And every Boxing Day, she bought the front two rows of the Royal Circle in the Alhambra Theatre in Bradford to go to the pantomime. And if you were able to behave yourself, I think I was four when I first went, you went to the pantomime, and I just fell in love with the Moth Ballet. The sequins and all the glitter, and, you know, the war was so drab, especially in the north of England. So there I was, stage struck, which continued. When I got to my grammar school, we'd moved south. My mother and I had moved south by then. It was very enlightened, and we had clubs on Thursday afternoons, and of course I joined the dramatic club. So, girls' school, I played Hamlet when I was 17, and various other leads. I made all the costumes, I helped with the scenery, I did everything, I loved it. And my mother said, remember, this was a grammar school, when I was 17, I really wanted to go to RADA. And she said, well, I can see that you have what I would call a vocation. She was a teacher, very good teacher. But it's a world we know nothing about, and your father would have wanted you to go to university if you could. Now, this was something I couldn't argue with this. I don't remember my father at all. He was killed by the time I was two, I think. So I couldn't reply to this, but I did sort of do it on my own terms. Instead of doing all the entrance examinations, I only did the entrance examinations for Cambridge, because I knew I could act more in Cambridge than in Oxford. This was 56, 57. And I went to Girton. I cycled a lot, which is quite a thing now that I'm disabled, but never mind. And I joined all the clubs that I could, and I did as much acting as I possibly could there, reviews to Shakespeare and everything in between. And, of course, one met professional directors, producers then, and one of them, Michael Bakewell, said, I think you should learn about radio. I think you should learn to use a microphone. And so he gave me a tiny part. You wouldn't be able to do that now. You wouldn't be able to afford it over one Christmas. And I was terrified. I was just so frightened. But in 1965, having done various things and been out of work in the usual way of actors, I was asked to join the BBC Drama Repertory Company, which we then called the REP, but is now called the Radio Drama Company, the RDC. And you do everything then. You get a script, sometimes for the same day. There was schools radio, there was Radio 3, third programme then. So it was an extraordinary mix across the board. And it took me about 6 years to stop being frightened of the microphone. But then I learnt that it was my friend, and I learnt how to use it to move closer to it if I wanted to sound really sexy and intimate, or move away from it if I wanted to go out of the room, for instance.
And technology must have changed an enormous amount, yes, over those 60 years.
Yes. Yes, indeed it did. We started off with the old-fashioned radio mono microphones that you see, the square sort of in a frame of metal, and it was very easy to blow into those. They didn't have these lovely baffles that you have now, so you had to learn to breathe beside the microphone, as it were, and not always to speak on the breath, which is not what you do when you're singing. So, you know, it's a different skill. But I loved it. I've always liked the exercise of a skill. I did a lot of dubbing at the same time, and, you know, dubbing films it's very little done now. But then you did a lot of foreign language films dubbed into English, sometimes very well, sometimes you can't tell.
And you were telling me a lovely story about acting with Vincent Price.
Ah, yes, and this is to do with the technology, because in the 60s, in came stereo. Indeed, there was one director who was into quadraphonics, the whole quadrasonic sound, and that was tremendous. But we decided that it was only he and his wife who was ever going to listen to it. Anyway, from working on these square, boxy mono mics, you had your opposite number, the other person in the scene, or people, on the other side, so you could look at them and interact in that sort of way. And then came stereo, where the microphone was set against the wall and we stood round in a circle. And I did not exactly an Edgar Allan Poe, but it was a horror radio play with Vincent Price, who I'd worked with on television, actually, before, so I knew him. And he was horrified by this. He said, "Do you mean to say we have to speak the whole thing to the wall?" And we did. You couldn't even turn your head to the man or woman beside you, because your voice would change. Your voice would move away from the microphone.
And it's not just the technology that's changed over the years. I also notice how much the voice has changed on R&IB talking books over the decades, that the received pronunciation that was very prevalent in the 50s and 60s has given away to a far more natural voice.
I suppose so, although in the 50s and 60s we thought that was natural. My natural accent, I don't think I've got one now anymore, but I moved south at the end of the war from Stockton-on-Tees. And I was made great sport with in the new school I went to, because I said bath and path and gas mask. And children are incredibly sensitive about that sort of thing. I very soon learnt to speak Fen, really, Cambridgeshire Fen. And I remember one of my teachers saying, "But you mustn't lose your beautiful clean vowels." I didn't know I had clean vowels at the age of 7. However, I have always been... I recognise voices. I'm tuned into it, sort of. And I've taught in radio, in drama schools, about 4 drama schools I've taught in. And I've taught radio and how to use the microphone. And I've written for radio.
Do you think it's a prerequisite for an actor, especially a voice actor, to have a good ear for accents then?
It helps. It certainly helps. As does a certain amount of, certainly if you're reading for the RNIB, a certain amount of education. When I started in 1966, early in 1966, I could still go to the lovely BBC pronunciation unit, which is no more, and ask them how to pronounce things. So you hear in the RNIB, if you get a book with words you can't pronounce, you're on your own. You have to do your own research, your own homework. And some of my friends who still do a lot, I've got some, but they have a whole shelf full of pronunciation dictionaries, and I've got old-fashioned dictionaries which give you pronunciations. And there are websites that you can go to. But you have to do that. Otherwise, you can come up with some very embarrassing pronunciations, which I'm sure everybody listening has probably heard BBC announcers are now doing. I mean, I'm sometimes screaming at the radio, saying, "You don't pronounce it like that."
And it's one of the lovely things. I sit outside the green room where all the narrators gather for coffee and lunch breaks. And the conversations are very rarely about politics or what's in the news. It's almost always about the books that they're reading or the way that this has been written or that's been pronounced. It's a lovely distraction, actually, from what's going on outside the RNIP Talking Book Studios.
Yes, I suppose the current word is niche, isn't it? I suppose it is a very narrow world, but I think we give pleasure to quite a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise have access to books, because Braille must be very hard work.
So many of us who've had sight loss later in life never bother learning Braille because it is very difficult.
Yes.
So having the books that you and the other narrators read for us is just wonderful. Otherwise, I couldn't read anymore. I must say, one of the first books I came across you narrating, however, was when I was at university, when I was first diagnosed with sight loss. And I was a second-year English undergraduate, and I'd just been set the task of reading Pamela.
My goodness.
Yes, by Samuel Richardson. And I was delighted to find that somebody had already done the hard work for me and narrated all 44 hours of it.
I know.
And that was you. So
I know. I'd forgotten about that. It did seem to go on forever and ever.
Well, you made it a far more pleasurable read for me.
Thank you.
Helped me pass that paper. The cross-section of books that you have read covers every single genre, from biography. I noticed there's a wonderful one of Mary Wollstonecraft.
Yes, that was a great book. And I've often gone back to that, actually. You shouldn't give me credit for that, for the wide range, because when I started, you read what you were given. You had no choice. And then there came in a lovely, relaxed atmosphere where you could actually say, oh, I'd like to read that. I think that's when I did the Mary Wollstonecraft, actually. Mm. But that's gone now. You get told, we'd like you to read so-and-so. You can say no, but you don't choose.
And I also hear you and the other narrators swapping tips sometimes. You were telling me a wonderful one about how to stop your tummy rumbling earlier.
Oh, yes, a banana is... I mean, you eat it. You don't do anything else with it. But biscuits are not much good because they clog up the mucous membranes and everything, and coffee's bad, and tea's not very good. Water's fine, but just between coffee and lunchtime, your tummy sometimes does start to rumble. And of course, the microphone is actually nearer to your stomach than it is to your mouth. And you can't have the noises. Very distracting, I would imagine. So a bite of banana is the answer to that, or a banana for coffee time.
And do you still do voice exercises, or are the muscles so used to narrating and acting that you just slip into your narrator's voice quite naturally nowadays?
Well, I sing. I joined a choir when I moved out of London, and that helps. That's enormously helpful. And I do exercises for that, obviously. But I'm blessed with having a pretty flexible voice. It was, when I started here, it was very high register. It was, I remember an American actress saying, you sound like the young Glynis Johns. And that goes back, actually, to the received pronunciation. Because if you listen to Queen Elizabeth when she first was Queen, she's very much up there. Tiny little voice, all in the head. No chest register at all.
You obviously use a different register for whether you're acting younger parts or older parts. Does it get exhausting?
Yes, it does, especially when the book's not very well written. One of the ones I've done recently had two girls speaking to each other. They were speaking in French, but of course it was written in English. One was Hungarian, who'd learnt French, and the other was English, or Irish English, who'd learnt French. Now, you can't give either of them an accent. It would just be ridiculous, because they both have a similar accent. And that I had to redo some of it because it became very confusing. The book wasn't very well written in that the characters didn't particularly come through the way that it was written. So, yes, it can be really difficult.
And do you ever listen back to the audiobooks that you've narrated, or does that make your toes curl?
It does slightly, and hearing myself on radio sometimes, you get things on Radio 4 Extra now that go way back, and I was listening to something while I was doing something else, I mean like sewing or washing up. And this William Trevor play came on, and I thought, oh, lovely. And then I listened, and I thought, oh, that girl is terrible. Why didn't they get me to do it? And then I thought, oh, my God, it is me. One day, when there was a good deal of kicking, my mother whinnied to me to come to her. And then she said, I wish you to pay attention to what I am going to say to you. The coats who live here are very good coats, but they are cart horse coats, and of course they have not learned manners. You have been well bred and well born. Your father has a great name in these parts, and your grandfather won the cup 2 years at the Newmarket races. Your grandmother had the sweetest temper of any horse I ever knew, and I think you have never seen me kick or bite. I hope you will grow up gentle and good, and never learn bad ways. Do your work with a good will, lift your feet up well when you trot, and never bite or kick, even in play.
My guest, Elizabeth Proud, narrating Black Beauty by Anna Sewell, which is TB1713. For a full list of the scores of titles that she's narrated for the RNIB Talking Books Library, go to the website rniblibrary.com. or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Do you have a favourite narrator that you love to listen to? Or maybe you've got an educating read suggestion for a book that you think would expand my horizons? Why not drop us a line via email? The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.